Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the mega city metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and for episode 152, we have some footage coming to you from this year's Toronto Comic Con, held on March 15th through to the 17th. We had a great time. I was only able, unfortunately, to attend the Saturday festivities, which was an absolute great time. I went down with Martin Slam Duncan. Big shout out to the Fastball Special. We had a really good time visiting some of our artist friends, Shane Heron, Christopher Yao. We saw Mike Ruth there. We also got to chat for a while with some very legendary artists and writers, one of which is the focus of this week's episode. So on the Saturday, the reason why I chose the Saturday out of the three was that the panels that were going to be available for that day really piqued my interest. So if I had to choose just one day to visit the con this year, I wanted to see Steve Englehart as well as Denny O'Neill, which are going to be back-to-back episodes for you for episode 152 as well as 153. Now, for those who may not recognize the name Steve Englehart, most of us do or are familiar with the Avengers and the Guardians of the Galaxy as well as Captain America, the Defenders, Doctor Strange, etc., etc. Some very famous storylines from Batman. Well, he didn't create these characters, as we all know, but he definitely left his fingerprint on the universe, both the Marvel Universe as well as DC. And his most prolific era would have been in the 1970s and then into the 1980s as well, having worked on such titles as Fantastic Four, as well as a pretty significant run on the Silver Surfer. So it was really cool to be able to have him visit Toronto. I think perhaps for the first time in many years, he gets into it on this week's episode. But here's a guy whose storylines and character developments of a lot of the things that we see in the movie were coming from his pen, from his imagination. So to be able to pick his brain, as well as we went to his table after his panel, but also within the panel, we were able to ask him some questions. Martin Slam Duncan and myself were able to ask some questions, and we had a great time. He was a really fun creator to talk to get his insight on an era that, I mean, for myself personally, really intrigues me and interests me, but I didn't get to live through it, so I'm able to enjoy it retroactively. So this panel was hosted by Mark Asquith, who will introduce himself at the beginning. I hope you guys all enjoy it. If you enjoy the Cave of Solitude podcast, rate and review us on iTunes, follow us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, and you can email us at caveofsolitude@outlook.com. So without further ado, here is the panel from this year's Fan Expo with Steve Englehart.
So I was the creator of Prisoners of Gravity and the founding producer of Space. And so comics, and I ran the Silver Snail from 82 to 87. So big history with comics, big history with interviewing people. And yesterday was the first time that I got to meet Steve, which is cool. And he was actually in Toronto in the early 70s. So you went to, you want to explain it?
Well, there was a show at York University in January. So we spent all our time in the tunnels underneath. And I'm trying to reconstruct it. I think it was 73. Because by 74, I'd moved to California, and I don't think I was doing a long commute. I think I probably just came up with New York. So probably January 73, the last time I was here, which is why when they asked me to come, I said, sure, I'll come.
Yeah. And who was there? So Alan Lee Weiss was there?
Neil Adams was there. Starlin was there. Kaluta was there. Howie Chaykin was there. Howie Chaykin, for those who don't know, he likes to disrupt things, right? Some people are nodding.
He was here last year.
Okay. So I can tell you the story that Howie and I were walking through some student union at York University, and in the midst of all these students diligently studying, Howie says, "Freaking Canucks!" And just walks on, you know? It's like, oh, well, he didn't say freaking either.
I've seen photographs of him from that show, and a hairier man, I cannot. He has had mutton chops that went up to about here.
It was the 70s, what are you going to say?
Well, we'll sort of begin, because if people rip in, that's fine. But I wanted to start in an unusual way in that we have something in common, which is we both wrote The Prisoner. I wrote the one with Dean Motter, and you wrote one with Gil Kane. So tell me about that project.
It was. I sort of fell into it. I was a big Prisoner fan, you know, watching it on TV. And then Marvel got the rights to do The Prisoner because Marv Wolfman was the editor, and Marv Wolfman was going to write it. And then, for whatever reason, Marv didn't write it, so it fell to me. And I was in the process of, you know, going through that. They gave me, one thing they gave me, though, was like all the scripts. I had all 16, 17 scripts, which was cool. And then I quit Marvel. Things happened, and I decided to leave Marvel. And they said, okay, turn in everything that you're in the middle of doing. And I said, yeah, but I'm going to write The Prisoner before I go. And they said, only if you turn it in tomorrow. Now, usually it takes me a good part of a week to write, well, not doing an adaptation, but it would take me several days to write a script. But I had to do it overnight. I was staying with Al Milgram in his apartment in New York. All he had was a typewriter back in those days, right? So I stayed up all night, and it was an adaptation of the first episode. So, you know, it's like, okay, I can do that. Bing, 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 bing. Took it in the next morning. Somebody ran off a Xerox on a really bad Xerox machine. So the only copy that I ever had of it later is very spotty and hard to read and so forth. But you are certainly aware that the Titan guys, right?
Yeah.
Just did this huge, huge reprint of it where they had, you know, Kirby, well... So after Gil Kane and I did this thing, for whatever reason, Marvel decided they didn't want to publish that. So then they gave it to Kirby, and then they decided they didn't want to publish that. And so it was like legendary for years that there were these, you know, particularly the Kirby one, of course, but I mean, that there were these two prisoners out there. And now Titan Books has published this thing, full-sized artwork for, what, 75 pounds, a good price, certainly, but has the Kirby stuff, has the Gil Kane stuff, has my stuff, but theirs is real size, mine is, you know, script size, whatever. It's a nice package if you like The Prisoner, if you like that stuff.
And what Steve is referring to is they shot and printed the art, the black and white art is shot in color, and it's printed the same size as the original art was done on, so it's two up, and it's gorgeous.
Right.
When I was writing The Prisoner in the 80s, I was friends with some of the editors at Marvel, and they said, oh my, you have to see this thing, which at that point was legendary, because there really wasn't an internet, the fandom and comic book journalism was really in its early... stages, and people really didn't know what was out there. I discover now with eBay, you know, it's become the world's attic, so we're discovering all kinds of projects and really cool things that we didn't know existed.
Yeah.
So, but let's start, I want to begin with the beginning of your career. You began as an artist. You weren't going to be a writer early on.
Right, it was the art that brought me into comics. Because of the Batman 80th anniversary, I got asked by Sci-Fi recently which issues of Batman, like, really stick with you. And the ones I came up with were the first two I ever saw, First Detective and First Batman. And looking at that, I was reminded, sorry to say, when I was starting out in comics, it was the 50s, and reading comics. They had Dick Sprang, they had various and sundry people who could do really cool art, but the stories were usually pretty pedestrian back in the 50s, and so it wasn't the stories that brought me into comics, it was the art. I will try to tell this succinctly.
We have a lot of time.
Well, no we don't. So I wanted to be an artist, and having no shame or sense, I went to my favorite artist, who was Neil Adams, and said, would you ever want to have an assistant? And he said, sure, how about we start now? Which was kind of the way Neil operated.
And how old would you have been at that point?
23, 24, something like that. I was in the Army, the American Army at that time, too. I took it one afternoon. I didn't have anything else to do, so I hopped on a train and took the train up from Maryland, where I was stationed down near Washington, D.C., up to New York City, where Neil and all the comics were, and went in and asked him this question. And he said, sure, you know, and I said, well, I'm in the Army. And he said, can you come up every weekend? And I said, yeah, probably. And he said, okay. So I was still in the Army for 6 months while I was working with Neil. And Neil was just a fabulous guy and made sure that I got a credit. Assistants never get credits, right? But he made sure that when this thing was printed, it was a Denny O'Neill story published in the Vampirella magazine. It wasn't Vampirella, but it was one of the other things. But it said, by Neil Adams and Steve Englehart. So then I was able to kind of, like, when I got out of the Army and went to New York, I was able to get to, you know, do stuff. And I was working my way up the way young artists do. And then the thing about comics in those days was pretty much everybody lived in New York because it was before the internet, before FedEx. It was just physically, you sort of had to go in and hand things to people and so forth, which was extremely cool. I mean, I didn't necessarily like New York, but I had to move to New York. But it was cool because everybody in comics was in New York, so I got to meet everybody, including Wally Wood and Will Eisner and Bill, Bill Everett, yeah. You know, people that I considered legends and the new guys like me who just showed up, everybody. And one of them was Gary Friedrich, who wrote Sergeant Fury and Nick Fury. And one day, a stewardess was murdered in the apartment above Gary's apartment. And his wife said, I don't feel comfortable living here now. Let's go back to the Midwest where you're from. And so I got this call. I'm just doing my thing, and I got a call from Gary Friedrich, and he said, would you like to come sit in for me for 6 weeks at Marvel? Doing low-level editorial stuff, you know, just proofreading and corrections and making sure the book's shipped and all that. And I almost said no, because it wasn't what I was doing, but it's like, yeah, okay, fine, I'll come do 6 weeks at Marvel. And at the end of 6 weeks, Gary decided that he wanted to stay in Missouri, and he was so laid back that he didn't want to write this six-page monster story that he was supposed to dialogue. It had already been drawn, but it was supposed to. So he sent it back, and Roy Thomas, who was the editor at the time, you know, kind of looked around the room. You want to write this thing? You know? I'm like, sure, why not? I do anything you ask me to do, right? So I wrote it, and I liked writing it, and they liked what I wrote. So then they said, you want to do some more? And then that's how I became a writer.
A year later, you were writing a book a week.
Yeah.
Almost a book a week.
Yeah.
So,
well, that's how comics were, right? I mean, there were so many books. The only thing that Roy said to me when he gave me Captain America, which was a little bit further down the line, he said, if you can turn this in on time every month and you can make it sell, you can keep doing it. And if you can't do either one of those things, we'll fire you and we'll get somebody who can do that because we have no time to do editorial stuff. So all the books were basically edited by the writers who wrote them. And again, it was the time when they just said, here, you're doing Captain America. Have a good time. You know, I mean, there was no connections to movies and lunchboxes and all the rest of this stuff. There was no world of comics outside of comics. So you were just doing comics within that world. And yes, so they, you know, to fill in that little blank, first you started out on romance stories and Western stories, which Marvel was still publishing, but they weren't the superhero things. So you weren't, you know, they weren't throwing you in to where people were actually spending their money. And they continued to like what I did. So then I got The Beast in Amazing Adventures, and right after that, he gave me Defenders and Captain America, and right after that, I got The Avengers, and then I got The Hulk, and then I got Doc Savage, and then I got Doctor Strange, and it was just like, that's how freelance comic book writing went. It's like, you got room for another one? Here, have it, you know? I mean, you want to, you know? So when I got up to a book a week, Doctor Strange actually took me to 5 books every 4 weeks, and at that point I thought, that's about enough, you know, I basically had a schedule where I would do a book a week. I would do 2 days of thinking up the plot, 3 days of scripting the thing, well, you know, it depended on how the process worked, but 2 days to think it up, 3 days to write it, 1 day to let it sit there and let me think, did I leave something out, did I want to fix that, did I do something, and 1 day off, and then I'd start the next one, and when I got started, one other of my friends at the time was Dick Giordano, who went on to become editor-in-chief at DC, but and I think he was at that time, but he'd started out as an inker, and one day he said to me, I'm really glad I'm an inker, because when I get old, I can just sit here and I can just ink, you know, whereas every writer I've ever known burns out, he said to the guy who was just starting out in his writing career, right? So I decided right then and there I was not going to burn out, and the solution to that was when my brain started to turn to cheese from writing a book every week, I would leave, you know? So I wrote, you know, for Marvel in the 70s and some DC stuff, and then I left and, you know, and took off and went and actually went to work for Atari and did video games for a while. And then I came back in the 80s and did that for a while, and then I left and I went and wrote children's books, you know, for Avon and so forth. And it was, I credit that to the fact, I mean, nobody's brain, I wouldn't say nobody actually, because Stan Lee kind of did it. But I mean, you know, if you're going to write that many stories.
He was doing like 25 or 30 books. No, 13 books.
13. When Stan hired Denny and Roy as his assistant, Stan himself was writing 13 books a month, which is like...
And he was the editor.
Only Stan could do that, right? Yeah, you know. And that comes, that's, you know, that, and Stan invented the thing where he would like tell the artist the plot and let the artist figure out how to tell that story, and then he would dialogue it. That's the only way you could do that kind of thing. But still, all the way from Millie the Model to Fantastic Four, right? All that was all Stan before he decided maybe he needed some help on that. And then, you know, so by the time I got there, Roy was the editor, and there were a number of us who came in. Steve Gerber, Don McGregor, there must be others, writers, and there are plenty of young artists. It was, you know, 70s was a pretty cool time to be doing comics, I gotta say.
Well, for me, it was a real time of discovery, and there were no, I grew up in Ottawa, there were no local comic book stores. That hadn't really come to Canada in a big way. In Toronto, they had a couple of stores, Captain George's Memory Lane, and they had conventions, like the one at York, but in Ottawa, we didn't have anything like that. So I would go and like do what a lot of people my age did, was get them off the spinner rack. Mm-hmm. And it was an incredible period, as you say. Don McGregor doing Black Panther, your work. And I want to talk about, so you did the Defenders, and Doctor Strange was in the Defenders.
Right.
And then you did the Doctor Strange book when he got put into Marvel Premiere.
Yeah.
And what was the difference between writing those two incarnations of Doctor Strange?
Well, the Defenders was first, and so I was given this team. I really liked the team, you know, but you're basically, Doctor Strange at that point is more of a superhero who does his things because it's magic rather than because he has a suit of armor or whatever it is, you know. We did mystical stuff, but it was still kind of in the context of a superhero kind of thing. When Frank Brunner was doing the art on Doctor Strange, the book, and his previous author, Gardner Fox, dropped off, Frank asked for me to come in and do it because we knew each other and he figured I would be on his wavelength and so forth. And then we really tried to do the Sorcerer Supreme. I really wanted, if this is the guy, he's not a guy with a suit of armor. He knows all the stuff that none of the rest of us know. Sure, I'll write a guy that knows stuff that I don't know. That'll be great. But really tried to make it a cosmic, and it was the 70s again, you know, so I really wanted to make it a cosmic sort of book where he would, as he did, he met God, he met death, he met himself. I mean, it was a lot of psychological, cosmic stuff, and so that was different from the Defenders. It was more superhero-oriented magic in the Defenders.
What was the editorial response to Doctor Strange meeting God?
Well, you're asking me for that story, right?
I'm no fool. I know where the stories are.
So we did this story in which he met this guy who was going backward in time, and it was a three-issue thing, but eventually he got to the beginning of time.
Can you pronounce it? Because I've been calling it Sisenig.
Sisenig.
That is right?
Sisenig, yeah.
Okay.
Which is Genesis spelled backwards, right?
Clever writer.
I know. Anyway, we get back to the dawn of time, and this is the only magical force there, and so I forget exactly how, I mean, I don't think we said this is God, but we made it pretty clear that that's what was going on. And then Roy said, and there was no editorial oversight. I mean, there was nobody was like, you didn't have to clear anything, and you never got any feedback. But in this case, Roy came over and he said, well, Stan's not totally on board with the idea of having God in these books, you know? And it was right around Christmas time. I was living in California. My family, I'm from Indiana, which is south of Chicago. And I was going to fly, and I was going to fly. I had to fly to Dallas, then up to Indianapolis. So I wrote this letter, which I said, you know, dear Mr. Lee, I am a minister, and I'm so impressed with, you know, the comic book that you've done here about God. And gave it a return address of some place in Dallas and mailed it in Dallas to be sure that it, you know, the postmark was good and all this stuff, you know. And when the new year came and you know, all the holidays were over, I heard that Stan had gotten this letter and he was so impressed by the whole thing. Roy used to say Stan could be deluged by a postcard. Was something Roy said to me once. So, you know, I mean, that story, you know, it was like a super secret concept for about 10 years, and then it sort of got out there, and then, you know, and Stan lived another, you know, 40 years after that. So I'm sure Stan heard about it. He never said anything to me about it after that, you know, but we were trying to do the most cosmic stuff we could in Doctor Strange, and we did not want anybody coming around and saying, here's the limit, you know, because we didn't want to have limits on that book.
How influenced were you by the work of Ditko and Colin, who really the first major forces on that early book?
Well, Ditko, certainly. I mean, Ditko is Doctor Strange. I mean, a lot of people, and I wouldn't fight him, would throw Brunner in there now, too, as a guy who's semi... But, I mean, everything's based on Ditko. It was all Ditko's ideas, his concepts, his visuals. Anybody who does Doctor Strange is going to draw Ditko visuals in there. I had really liked the Gene Colan stuff with Roy that had happened before. But that, I don't think... You know, that was Roy put him in the costume then and so forth. And I mean, it was good, but it didn't influence me at all. But certainly, and what we were trying to do was had not been done before with the really making him a cosmic thing. But it all starts with Ditko. And then after Brunner, after the book became popular and it turned into a monthly book, Frank was a slow enough artist, he couldn't keep up with it, so he had to drop off. And they gave me Colin, and I loved working with Colin. You know, I mean, it was the Brunner stuff was, I would say, magical. It all sort of sparkled, and it had, you know, that vibe to it. Colin stuff is photographic, which I really liked too, because to do magic, now that we'd established him as this really cosmic guy, to see it kind of very realistic. But Colin could do cosmic things too. So I really liked working with Gene, but he was not an influence beforehand.
So when you were working with Brunner, I mean, you guys were friends.
Yeah.
And I've read that you collaborated in an unusual way. Like, you really were in the same room and working stuff out, just hashing it out.
Yeah. I mean, usually when you see credits, it'll say written by Englehart, drawn by whatever. You know, I mean, that kind of thing. But Frank had asked for me to come on. Because he thought when he was working with Gardner Fox, Frank had ideas about things he wanted to do, but Gardner was old school, and Gardner really couldn't do what Frank wanted to do. Frank thought I could. So I appreciated the invitation, and since Frank had ideas, we worked out this situation where it was a bi-monthly book in the beginning, and I lived up in Connecticut, he lived in New York at that point. And so every 2 months, I'd go to his place or he'd go to my place. We'd have dinner, and then we'd just sort of spend the rest of the evening as late as it took, sometimes till 3 or 4 in the morning. Frank would say, I want to do this. And I'd go, yeah, well, I've been thinking I want to do this. And then it was up to me as the writer to figure out how to put those things together so we could both do what we wanted to do. And in the process, it would become more than the sum of those parts. And then, you know, and so by the end of the night, we would have the story that we wanted to do, and then that's what we did, you know. With Colin, it was different. Colin had no interest at all in plotting stuff. It's just put it in front of me and I'll draw it. So that's how I did it with Frank, or with Gene. But with Frank, yeah, it was very different. And so the credits always say co-created or co-written or co-done something, you That was an unusual thing. I did it with Al Milgram on Captain Marvel too, but that usually that isn't how it worked.
A couple of ways we could go here, but a couple of days ago, Master of Kung Fu found its director, and it looks like it's going to be part of this next wave of Marvel movies. What's your response to that, having created the character?
Oh, I'm really happy. I mean, when they did, I mean, see, Starlin and I came up with the idea of Master of Kung Fu. I wanted to do Eastern philosophy. Starlin was interested in that as well, but he liked the visuals. And we went to Marvel, and we said, we want to do this book about Kung Fu. And this was before there was any sort of Kung Fu vibe. The TV show had just started, but there was no, you know, I mean, and Bruce Lee had done Enter the Dragon, you know, but I mean, it's like there was no Kung Fu thing, really. And so Marvel said, no, there's no interest in this. And we said, no, we could do it. And they said, well, okay. But if you're going to do it, you got to put Fu Manchu in it, right? Because you got to have a recognizable Chinese character. And we're like, yeah, that's not really what we had in mind, but if that's the ticket to getting it done, okay. And the other thing was, we had heard that the Kung Fu TV show, they had thought about casting Bruce Lee for it, but the network said, no, you can't have an all-Chinese guy. He's got to be at least half white for our 1970s TV audience. So when we went to Marvel, we said, we're making our guy completely Chinese. And they said, no, there's, you know, got to have a white connection in there if you want to sell it. So he became half white. So there were editorial things, right? But anyway, so we got this book, put in the most obscure title ever, Marvel Special Edition number 16 or something for the first one, 15 maybe. And we did an issue, and then we did a second issue, and right at that time, Kung Fu just exploded. Just went, you know, worldwide, everybody fell into Kung Fu. The upshot of that was twofold, maybe. One, we were looking to do a bi-monthly book that involved Eastern philosophy, and all of a sudden they wanted to make it a monthly book, and they wanted a giant-sized book in addition, and they wanted special editions in addition, and they wanted a black and white magazine in addition. And so Starlin and I kind of bailed. But another aspect of that was the same people who had said there's no interest in Kung Fu said, oh, let's create our own Kung Fu character, and that was Iron Fist, right? So when Netflix did the Iron Fist thing and didn't do Master of Kung Fu, that I'm like, yeah, I don't know about this. But I also thought, well, now that they've done that, they'll never do Master of Kung Fu because they've got their Kung Fu character here, right? And then the series wasn't any good. But even then, it's like, that still, they've gone down that road and it didn't work for them. So now they're certainly not going to do this. But it's basically the Black Panther movie, you know. When the Black Panther movie said, oh, if you do a movie that's all, you know, done by black people and a lot of black people will show up for it, maybe Asians. Maybe we can do that with Asians, you know, and Crazy Rich Asians was in there too, right? So I'm sure, I mean, I'm not even guessing. That is the genesis of when they finally decided, oh yeah, let's do Master of Kung Fu. So, and it's going to be an all-Asian director, writer, all that good stuff, you know. And they don't talk to us about the movies. I mean, they're very good about, if they're going to do Master of Kung Fu, they're going to read the Master of Kung Fus, and if they find stuff that they want to use, they will use it, and they'll credit us, you know, but they don't consult. So I don't know more about this movie than you do. But hopefully, you know, I mean, I have great faith in Marvel movies. Captain Marvel, a little bit.
Well,
not up to snuff, but, you know.
Well, let's talk about that, because some of the major characters that you have been involved with have made the transition to film. So let's talk about Captain America. I mean, my favorite Captain America movie is Winter Soldier. Brilliant.
But they've all been, I mean, starting then, all Marvel movies got to be pretty good. Well, with Captain America, when they gave me Captain America way back in the beginning, it was a failing book because it was Vietnam War time in America. A large part of your potential audience was living with the idea that they might get called up and sent to Southeast Asia to get killed. So they weren't really, and they were billing Captain America as the living legend of World War II. You know, he stood for America in the war. It's like that, you couldn't sell that. And so they, you know, the book was not doing well, so they gave it to the new guy, and they said, see if you can figure something out, because if you can't, we're either going to cancel it altogether, or at least we'll make it bi-monthly. And I went home that night, and the idea I came up with was to make him stand for American ideals, the stuff that you hear about that doesn't always show up in practice, but, you know, the stuff that you hear about. And that not only worked for that book then and there, but it became the default Captain America after that. That's the guy that's on screen now, right? That's what everybody thinks Captain America is.
And certainly that first movie really established that idea, that Cap is the idea of America, which I love. The Joe Johnson, it's really well done.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So what was, so watching him develop and now tied into the Avengers and all this stuff going on, are you just sort of, do you get invited to the premiere?
Yes, I do. Anybody that I created, for example, I didn't create Captain America, so no. I don't get invited to a Captain America. Well, actually, I have been. I guess they do that now, actually. But theoretically, it's people that I created. So I get invited to Guardians of the Galaxy. I'll get invited to Master of Kung Fu. You know, I got invited to Luke Cage when it premiered in, you know, on Netflix, that kind of thing. I didn't create Luke Cage either, but I guess I'm associated with it enough, you know. Marvel, it's a, now, you know, I said when we started it was just comic books. Now, of course, it's the whole Disney empire thing. But on the other hand, you know, the money they spend on lunch is the money they can pop out to, you know, to fly me to places and to go to premieres and stuff like that. And that's, and yeah, it's cool. I mean, you know, the last Avengers movie, they had to do it in three theaters. They had so many people there, right? And but you walk on the wet red carpet. There's a wall down the red carpet, and the cool people, the actors, are out being interviewed on this side of the red carpet. But you're walking down a red carpet, at least down the other side of it. You get free popcorn. You know, I mean, and then there's an after party where, you know, you can go hobnob with people, which is kind of fun. I mean, that's not my world, or it hasn't been. Now it's sort of becoming a little bit of my world. After the last Avengers movie, I was talking to Joe Russo, and he said, "How'd you like that big surprise at the end?" And I said, "What surprise?" And he goes, "Well, they all died." And I'm like, "Dude, I've written comics for a very long time." that just went right, you know, that didn't shock me at all, right? Well, which I think shocked him, because he thought, you know, but, you know, I mean, so that's my life now, you know.
Well, let's talk about the early, so the first time that Hollywood came calling, I gather, was the Batman. You had done those wonderful issues with Walt Simonson and Marshall Rogers, and so how did your involvement, Michael Uslan call you, or the executive producer? No.
No. Everything I just said nice about Marvel, I would say the exact opposite about DC. DC is very, they're not fun to work with at all. I wrote that Batman stuff. I really wanted to make Batman somebody that adults could relate to, you know? So I gave him a sex life with Silver St. Cloud. I brought back the Dark Joker. I just tried to do this Batman thing that could break out of the TV series, which was still what people were thinking about when they thought about Batman. And Denny and Neil had sort of started down that road, but it hadn't gotten, you know, hadn't gone that far. They were still doing the kind of 70s superhero guy, but a little darker. So I really, you know, did everything I did. And Mike Uslan was then quoted as saying, "Oh, I see how we could do a movie for adults with this stuff." Nobody talked to me. Nobody did anything. They went away for 10 years. They tried to make this movie. They had four different script writers, including Tim Burton, take a crack at it. And then 10 years later, I get a call from DC saying, "Nobody's been able to really get that vibe that you had, so we want you to come on and work as a script doctor for this thing and get it made." I found out much later that the deal they offered me was illegal under Writers Guild rules, but I didn't know because that wasn't my world. So I went and went through the scripts and I made suggestions and I reworked it. I didn't write any dialogue, but it was all script notes and, this is how it should go. And then they said, okay, good, now we can make this movie. And then every script for 10 years had been Batman and Silver St. Cloud and Boss Thorne. When they made the movie, they changed Silver St. Cloud's name to Vicki Vale, they changed Boss Thorne to Boss Grissom, and they said, then we don't owe you anything because it's not your characters. And if you want to see the movie, buy a ticket. It was like, DC is just horrible. So that's my story, I do think that movie came out pretty well, and I do think it was followed by several bad Batman movies, but I think a lot of people who sort of saw that movie then grew up to become the guys who were doing the stuff that works as superheroes in movies now.
A little offshoot to that is, tell me about collaborating with Marshall Rogers, because I gather you didn't even know he was going to draw.
No.
And you didn't do it Marvel method. You did a complete tight script.
Right. I had left Marvel, as I mentioned earlier, at that point in time, and my wife had traveled in Europe for a year before I knew her, and I said, well, that sounds good. If I'm going to quit comics, let's go to Europe for a while. And then Jeanette Kahn, new publisher at DC, called me up and said, could you come over here? We'd really like you to do for the Justice League what you did with the Avengers, to give them personalities and do stories and things, And I said, well, I can only give you a year. I can push off the trip to Europe for a year, but I can only do it for a year. Okay, fine. And I want to do Batman, because this is my one shot working for DC, I want to do Batman. And she said, okay. So I started out with Walt Simonson and Al Milgram doing it Marvel style, where I would say, here's the plot, and they would tell that story in art, and then I would write the dialogue. But for whatever reason, these were the days when the editors made all the decisions. I had nothing to do with it. But apparently the editor, Julie Schwartz, decided that he wasn't happy with the way that art was looking. So he said, we're going to get somebody else to do this. And it wasn't clear who and I was running out. I had a time constraint. So at that point, I started writing all the script in advance, which is the other way of doing it, like a movie script, panel one. Joe says this, Bill says this, panel two,
That and was that your first attempt at that?
No, I had done it a little bit back with Vampirella, but I had not done much of it. And my favorite approach is the Marvel style, because then I'm going to see exactly the same art that you're going to look at, and I can write the dialogue to enhance that and not step on it or miss it, whatever. But I had no choice. And I did find that if I wrote my own Batman scripts, I could control the pacing, which, a lot of that is mood, and a lot of that is the ambiance that nobody else could get, whatever. So I liked that part of it. But in any event, I wrote all these scripts. I went all the way to the end. I handed them in, and then I went to Europe. And that was, and the odds were that it was going to be drawn by, Joe Hack and Bill Journeyman, because most of DC's stars had gone to Marvel by that time. Neil Adams had gone to Marvel. Gil Kane had gone to Marvel. Bob Brown had gone to Marvel. So there wasn't really anybody left at DC who would do Batman who was going to be probably any good. And I will tell you, quite frankly, if you had seen those same scripts, exact same scripts, drawn by second-rate guys, you would think it was a second-rate series. I've learned people can't like pick it out and go, the writing was really good, but the art, people just go, it's a comic, and this is what I got out of it. So I was expecting, okay, here's my best shot at Batman, and we'll see what happens. And then 6 months later, we were living in Mallorca, and I got a package, and I saw that stuff for the first time. And I literally said, thank you, God. It's like, wow, how amazing. And the interesting thing there, I didn't meet Marshall and Terry till I came back from Europe, obviously. They didn't tell me at the time. It wasn't until we did the Dark Detective stuff in 2005 or whatever that they told me that DC hated their artwork. And every month they would get called in and just get yelled at for how terrible this art was and how, you know, just, you got to change your style. This stuff is just not any good. It's like blah, 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 blah. And they held their ground, and there it is, right? But DC didn't like it.
Well, even the little things, like the lettering, I mean, the whole thing, and the thicker lines, I mean, there was something about that book. You're absolutely right. It was the tone, it was the ambiance, and frankly, it was the page turns. Mm. You had some of the best page turns in comics.
Well, I am a professional at this point. But, yeah, well, I mean, I went back and looked at the original Batman stuff. I wanted to get that vibe, and one of the things was it was all very dark. It was, you know, they used a lot of ink in the early Batman stuff. And I, you know, we weren't going to do that. Art had progressed to that point. But I did ask to have all the panel borders made a little thicker, so there'd just be that little extra bit of darkness on the page, right? I figured this is my one shot at Batman, and I'm going to do, like, the best Batman that I can possibly do. As it turns out, Marshall and Terry and John Workman, who did the lettering, right? And I forget who did the cut. I forget who did the coloring. But, I mean, certainly Marshall, Terry, and John, they loved the Batman, too. And they wanted to do the best Batman they could possibly do. And so it came to pass. You know, and the movie came from it and all the rest of that stuff, right? But it was, DC was no help at all at any point in time.
Let's just switch back for a second to Marvel and Star-Lord, just because there's a huge interest in that stuff right now. So what were you asked to do, or did you come to them and say, here's what I have?
I don't quite remember, actually. I mean, they were trying to do more black and white magazines, which weren't under the comics code, so you could do stuff that they couldn't do in comics. I would assume that they came, I mean, it's almost certain, but I can't actually say, but it's almost certain that they came to me and said, we have a new magazine, we want you to come up with something for it, you know? Because you didn't, in those days, you didn't go to the editors and say, I mean, that thing where me and Starlin went in and said, we want to do Master of Kung Fu, that was kind of revolutionary. That's part of why it was so revolutionary. The two guys come in and say they want to do something. Usually you just got assigned whoever you got assigned, and that was, you know, that was the system, and that was fine. But anyway, so let's assume that they asked me to come up with something. And I, you know, what I wanted to do, this is my Star-Lord story, what I was going to do was I was going to create this guy who was a completely unsympathetic character. Just, you know, the worst guy. Nobody likes him. And then, over the course of 12 issues, he was going to turn into this sort of cosmic being, right? And the idea was he was going to travel out through space, and on each planet, he was going to have an adventure based on the mythology of the planet. So that on Venus, he would have a love story. And it would just be like a love story. And then on Mars, it would be a war story. And then, you know, and it would go all the way out. And by the time he had traversed all these different aspects of life, he would end up out past Pluto as this completely cosmic guy. This terrible person here had turned into this cosmic guy over here. So I did that first issue, then I left Marvel. That's the Marvel leaving time. And so, you know, Claremont and those guys, Byrne, Marvel said, here, do chapter two. They didn't know what I had in mind for chapter two. It's just like, okay, that's our assignment. So now let's figure out what we're going to do with this guy that nobody likes. Well, we'll take some of the edges off, and we'll do this, and so forth. So, you know, I get to say, yeah, I created Star-Lord. But, you know, most of what you know about Star-Lord was, you know, what transpired afterwards. And I suppose everybody's heard that they just got James Gunn back for the third Guardians of the Galaxy. So that's going to be cool. You know.
Well, I've sort of been hogging the mic here, so does anybody have a question or anything that they would like to ask or adjust? Yeah.
Sure. It's kind of an
off-topic
question, but you said you worked for Atari and did some video games.
Yeah.
The topic is Steve, so that was totally on topic. That was an excellent question.
Worked for Atari, that I worked for Atari and did video games. I did the most famous one, actually, is the E.T. game, which is the one, not the one they buried in the desert. There were two E.T. games. One was for the computer, which is what I did, me and the others, and the other was for the game machine, and that was the one that was so bad that they took it out in the desert and buried it. Ours was okay, you know? We worked on, there was a, after that, well, yeah, we did the E.T. game. We were doing one based on Camelot 3000, which was a Mike Barr book.
A DC book.
Yeah, that was really weird, actually, because Mike Barr came out to sell his thing to Atari, and he's talking to me, right? It's like, and I know, you know, I knew him. But,
and great art, by the way, Brian Boland, absolutely spectacular art.
Yeah, yeah. And there was a Garfield game, but I was there for 2 years, and at the end of 2 years, I was not in comics. I was not doing comics, but I went down to the San Diego convention, because I always did, and both Shooter at Marvel and Giordano at DC came up and said, would you like to do some comics again? And I'm like, no, I'm good. I'm doing video games now. And I went home, and that Sunday night, my boss at Atari called me up, and he said, they just sold the company, and I think we're all getting fired on Wednesday. So on Monday, I called up Shooter and Giordano, and I said, you know, I've thought this over. And so then I came back and did Green Lantern for DC, but I did West Coast Avengers and stuff for Marvel, you know.
Did you have a further question that you wanted to know, or did Steve sort of cover that?
You got it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You mentioned Marvel and DC working for both of them, but you also mentioned working in the Vampirella comics.
Yeah.
What was Warren Publishing like, and did you ever meet Jim Warren himself?
Yes, I did. I liked Jim Warren. He was a cool guy, I thought. He was sort of a flamboyant showman kind of guy. He always wore a blue shirt. Once when a bunch of us somehow went up to his apartment, he showed us all the bidet that he had in his apartment. You know, it's like, you know, he was a little larger than life, but he was a nice guy, I thought. And the Warren offices were like a lot of, I mean, they weren't a whole lot more elaborate than the Marvel offices in those days. I mean, it was just a place where people came and handed over stuff, and there was, you know, some production work being done there.
Did you work together as a group, or was everything done separately?
Everything was done separately. I mean, when I did that thing with Neil for the Vampirella magazine, later I did 4 issues of the Vampirella series, which was very cool with Gonzalez art and all that. So I knew Warren. Archie Goodwin had left by that time. So I think Bill Dubé was the editor. So there was an editor, and there was probably a couple guys who could do art on staff or that kind of thing. But it was really just an office in New York. I mean, you know, that had been outfitted for that kind of stuff. But I'm glad I had that opportunity. I mean, you know, again, it's like I was saying, it was cool to meet, you know, Bill Everett or Wally Wood. I'm glad that I overlapped with Jim Warren. And I'm sorry he couldn't keep it going, because those books were great.
They were.
Yeah.
Speaking of people you met, did you ever meet Steve Ditko, the elusive?
Yes. Yeah.
What was he like?
Pretty much what you've heard. I mean, he was very reclusive. He was dismissive of anything that he was dismissive of. I mean, if he wasn't into it, he'd let you know he wasn't into it. But, you know, I went up to his apartment once in New York, and then later I did a book in the 80s. I think it was called Fantasy Illustrated, but I could be wrong. But they said, we can set you up with Ditko for a thing. And so I tried to write the most Ditko story I could write. I mean, it was full of paranoia and shadows and weird guys lurking, and, you know. And he was kind enough to say that he did enjoy it, you know. And so, we talked about it at that time. I met him a couple of times, and he was, I didn't espouse liberal ideas, so I didn't get dumped on by him or anything, you know, I mean, it just, I was just there to be professional. Yeah.
So you go ahead.
I could be wrong, but I think I heard that you were the first person to write Silver Surfer after Stan Lee. He was the only writer before that.
Actually, John Byrne did a one-shot.
Okay.
In the middle.
So the question was that I heard you were the first person to write Silver Surfer after Stan Lee, which
right.
is corrected. But what was the main question?
What was it like to be the first one to do an ongoing Silver Surfer book for a character that Stan Lee had loved so much that he didn't really share it with just anybody?
Right. When Stan retired and became Stan Lee Presents, he said, the only thing I'm asking is nobody else gets to do the Silver Surfer. And that went on for a while. And then Roy kind of had the Surfer guest star in a proto-Defenders thing. And then, so when I got the Defenders, I got in touch with Stan, and I said, can I use the Surfer every once in a while in this book? And he's like, yeah, every once in a while you can do that. That's fine, you know. So that was cool. But as far as the Surfer in his own book goes, there was nothing, and then there was a one-shot John Byrne thing, and then they came to me and they said, Shooter called me up and he said, we're going to do a Silver Surfer book. And I said, how can you do that? Because Stan doesn't want that done. And Shooter said, Stan's not here, and I am. So if you've ever met Shooter, that's him, right? So he said, we're going to do this book. And I'm like, okay. And I said, I'm really, really sick of him being stuck on Earth and having to fly away at the end of every episode going, oh, I'm so put upon. I said, can't we get him out into space? And they said, no, can't do that. So I did a first issue with him trapped on Earth. He met Mantis. You know, I had to do something to, like, shake it up. And then, for whatever reason, they changed their minds. And they called me up and they said, okay, we've decided he can get off Earth, which was great. That's what I wanted to do. And that opened up the entire Marvel Universe, all the... You know, all those guys, the Elders and Galactus and the In-Betweener, and I mean, all the things that were flying around in the various incarnations of the Marvel Space Universe, they were all available to the Silver Surfer at that point. So it was a lot of fun. I really liked the Surfer, and having him being able to do something rather than not, you know, rather than be trapped. I mean, when he got trapped, that was a great thing. He'd been free forever, and now he was trapped. But it was now 15 years later, and he was still trapped. And it's like, yeah. So, yeah. And I never heard what Stan... I mean, whatever Stan had to say about that, he talked to Shooter about it. I never got any feedback from Stan on that. But it was, yeah, I didn't... That's a book I didn't expect ever to happen, and then it did. So
we have about 5 minutes left, so maybe a couple of questions. So I know you have one.
Okay, yeah. This is a Captain America question.
Yeah.
Secret Empire, the original, very political story in the 70s.
Yeah.
You had Steve walk away from the Shield. What was the sort of reaction back then to a story that was so much a commentary on the Vietnam War? And also, perhaps, if you could speak to the reactions to the current Captain America runs, which are, again, going back to the same kind of stories you wanted to tell back then.
Well, as I say, there was no editorial oversight. I was allowed to do whatever I wanted to do. And as I also said, a large part of our audience was influenced by the Vietnam War. So the idea of being against the Vietnam War was not a problem. I just thought Captain America was supposed to be living in the real world. And in the real world, in America, people were just mesmerized by Watergate. There were like three networks. They were all broadcasting the hearings that were happening, which were being conducted by reasonable politicians who might be on different sides of the aisle, but all felt that they had to do something correct for the ideals of America, unlike today. And so everybody was. It just made no sense to me that Captain America would keep fighting supervillains and not be influenced by what was going on in America. So it was my decision to go do to go in a political thing. And I did a comic book version of the Watergate thing. I didn't like rip it from the headlines per se. At the end where somebody in the Oval Office blows his brains out, it was my decision not to say it was Nixon, because Nixon hadn't been indicted yet, you know. And that seemed a bridge too far to me. But the reaction was uniformly positive. I mean, these days, I'm sure I'd get roasted on Twitter by all the right-wing lunatics, right? But in those days, we didn't have Twitter. So we had letters, but I don't recall really letters complaining about this at all.
So we're being wrapped. So thank you all for showing up. Thank you very much.
Darn.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. So I'm going to go back to my table. If you have more questions that didn't fit in here, come on by.
Which is exactly what we ended up doing. Myself, later on, Martin Slam Duncan and some other fans went over to Steve's table and chatted with him for, I would say, about 30 to 45 minutes. I didn't record it because it was a very casual, impersonal, or informal conversation, which was nice to have. There was no agenda involved in this conversation, but we talked about the Marvel movies that he really enjoyed, some of his gripes with the DC movies. He had just seen Captain Marvel a week before. He had a review for it, so it was really fun kind of talking to him as almost like a fan to fan, but also this gentleman having created characters like Star-Lord or Mantis and things like that. So it was a great time, and that's one of the best features of Artist Alley, when you're able to kind of do a little bit of history, knowing who's going to be there and knowing what it is that they worked on, and then you can go really get some inside scoops of what it was like to work in the comic book industry before an era of internet. So what we took away from that conversation was we exchanged email addresses, and hopefully very soon, maybe this year, fingers crossed, Steve will end up on the Cave of Solitude podcast, and we will have a more in-depth conversation for you to enjoy if you enjoyed this one. And I'll listen back to this one to make sure we don't ask any of those questions that he already answered here. So thank you once again for listening to the Cave of Solitude. I am your host, Eric Anthony. Very soon, I will be putting up the other panel that I was able to record. I had really good audio from that one as well, with comic book legend Danny O'Neill. Stay tuned for that. Thank you, everybody, for listening.